This is KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm Jenny Nyman, and it is time for the Kenai Conversation. We've got a really interesting one lined up today. We're going to be talking about a potential landslide and resulting tsunami that could be happening in Barry Arm in Prince William Sound really soon. This discovery shocked a lot of people. It really felt like it came out of left field, and we've got several of the folks involved in discovering this potential and researching it. We've got four folks on the line today. We are going to start with Valisa Higman, who is an artist in Seldovia. She was the one who first noticed this slope and thought maybe it looked a little askew and wondered about potential slide hazard, and mentioned it to her brother, who is a geologist with Ground Truth Alaska. Brettwood Higman, we're all pretty familiar with Hig, of course, from Ground Truth Trekking. He's also done an adventure talks with us at KDLL. And through his initial scratching his head, looking at the slope, got a bunch of other people involved. So also today, we're going to hear from Shunli Dai, who is a senior research associate with Bird Polar and Climate Research Center at Ohio State University. And also Dr. Gabriel Wolken with Alaska Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, and also a research professor at University of Alaska Fairbanks. Hello, everybody. Valisa, let's start with you. You were a artist in residence, I believe, correct, in Prince William Sound?
Yeah, I was participating in the Voices of the Wilderness program, which is put on around the state in various national forests and national wildlife refuges. And I've been selected by the Chugach National Forest to participate in their program.
And what time frame were you out in the sound?
It was the first 2 weeks of June. So the first day I actually went on a tourist boat paired with an interpreter from the Forest Service.
Okay. And Barry Arm, of course, the eastern sort of end of Harriman Fjord, a little northwest of Whittier. A lot of folks in this area are pretty familiar. It is a spectacular location. Kayakers love it. Shrimpers, fishermen, a lot of people out in that area. It's a pretty common destination for glacier cruises and whatnot. Had you been to that spot before, or was this your first time?
That was my first time. Pretty much my first time to Prince William Sound. I'd been through it on the ferry before, but had never spent much time there.
So what was your first impression?
Well, I mean, there's amazing glaciers going down straight to the water, which is really cool, and lots of really lush forest. It's similar to here in Seldovia, but there's also some major differences in vegetation and landscape, of course. So It was beautiful.
As you're looking around, taking in the glaciers, as you say, it's a pretty spectacular landscape. But what about, as you're taking all of that in, made you look at this one particular slope and start to kind of wonder?
Honestly, on that first day, I didn't notice anything. I was definitely thinking about glacial retreat because, I mean, there's a lot of dialogue about that on the boat, about islands that hadn't been there before and beaches that had changed in the last few years. But I went back towards the end of my residency in a smaller landing craft, and we landed next to Cox Glacier. So from there, I could look across and see the slope that we're talking about. And that was when I started to think that there might be something that my brother would be interested in.
And what was it about the slope? Did it look like top heavy? Were there rocks tumbling down? Was it just the grade of the slope? Like, what was it that made you start thinking, I wonder if that might slide?
Well, I've been to a lot of my brother's presentations about Ton Fjord and Grund Glacier. So first, the glacial retreat was a big warning sign, right? So you've got a slope that used to be held up by ice that is no longer held up by ice. It differed from a lot of the other slopes in the area in that some of them are more like solid rock and smooth, and this was more scree, loose rock, and then there was a horizontal line that went across it that looked like it maybe had slipped a little bit. And so what I was looking at actually wasn't the fracture line that we now know about. It actually is a lot bigger than what I thought it might be. But I had taken a couple photos and then passed those on to my brother, thinking that it might be something to look at, especially with all the tourist traffic in the area.
Right. I mean, that is, I hate to estimate, but that is at least one of the most popular destinations in Prince William Sound, especially because it is in the Northern Sound and it's more protected. I mean, you get a lot of, you know, fishermen and hunters down around Montague Island, but the waves can get a little gnarlier out there. So for kayakers and campers and hikers and smaller type boats, that Northern Sound is a little more palatable. Plus, as we said, that area is beautiful. One of the announcements that DNR sent out, Fish and Game, I think, was estimating as many as 500 people could be in that area at any one time.
Yeah, I mean, I believe it, with kayakers and shrimp boats and all sorts of people using that area.
So you took some pictures and you sent them to Haig. Haig, what was your initial reaction when you saw what your sister had sent you?
My initial take looking at the photos she sent was, you know, okay, this looks like a big slope that has a lot of this sort of this unstable material that you might wonder about. And what I often do when presented with something like that is I go to Google Earth, where you can see whatever imagery it is that Google's tacked up there. And in those images, you can see these cracks in the slope. But I was zoomed in actually much too far when I did that. I was looking at specific little breaks that are in, turns out in hindsight now, I know that those were just in the middle of this larger landslide mass. If I zoomed out a little bit, which I didn't, then the outline of the whole mass is quite clear. And I've seen other satellite photos since then that where it's even more clear. But that initial look was enough to tell me that, you know, this is definitely worth looking into. And it's, there are some things about that slope, how steep it is and how big it is, and the fact that the glacier rapidly retreated away from its base, that might indicate that it could be an important one to understand better.
And what's been your interaction with landslides and dangers like this in Alaska? As your sister mentioned, you've done some presentations on other slides in the state. So is this something that you have studied a lot?
Well, so my background, or a lot of the work I did in grad school and afterwards, is focused on geologic hazards and particularly on tsunamis. And so I had long been interested in tsunamis. I worked in the field after some earthquake-generated tsunamis. And then in 2015, there was a large landslide in Tanfjord in Icy Bay, not too far from Yakutat, that produced a very large tsunami. And for a long time, I'd wanted to look at the effects of a landslide-generated tsunami. It also happened in a place that I knew fairly well that I was really interested in. And so I kind of jumped in on that project and helped coordinate a project that ended up involving a very diverse group of researchers, about 30 different researchers out in the field. And so I got to learn a lot about this particular scenario where you have the glacial retreat and an unstable slope that fails. And in that case, it produced a tsunami that was about 630, well, the wave itself was probably around 300 feet, but the wave ran up the slopes to about 630 feet of elevation. And after seeing that then brought to my attention one slope we have near here, which is Gruink. And so for the last few years, I've been trying to figure out how to best approach understanding the hazard faced by this steep mountain slope above Gruink Lake across from Homer. And that's another place that, you know, has a lot of these same factors going on, but it also has a lot of visitors. So it's been, you know, a few years of learning about the particulars of this kind of hazard. This one, Barry Arm, is in some ways extremely similar to Tanfjord in particular, in that Tanfjord also had a slope that there was an obvious instability on that was actively moving for some time, and with the glacial retreat was sort of in progress at its toe. So a lot of things line up between Barry Arm and Tanfjord.
Except, as it turns out, this one looks like it could be multiple times larger.
That's right. Yeah, it's larger in volume by, you know, we don't know exactly what the volume of Berryarm landslide is, but our rough estimate anyway is like 6 or 8 times as big. It also is higher and steeper. So it's all of the things that you might worry about are more extreme here. And that really, you know, that makes it more dangerous for obvious reasons. There's more energy and such in that. It also sort of changes the nature of the hazard in some ways. I initially went into looking at Berryarm thinking in terms of quite localized hazard, because usually landslide tsunamis impact the area that's quite close to that landslide source. But this one, now we're realizing, as we've done a little bit of preliminary modeling, could have impacts that are much wider spread just because of the large volume of that landslide.
Right. And Whittier is, although it's around a corner, it's not that far away. That is a pretty big port with a lot of traffic in and out of there.
One of the things that is a little non-intuitive about tsunamis is that they're actually really good at going around corners. The name tsunami is a Japanese word. It means harbor wave. And the Japanese identified it in this way because even relatively small tsunamis were very destructive in harbors. And this is because they're much longer periods. So it takes longer for the wave to rise to its peak and then drop again. And so in that time, it can flood around corners and into protected bays that shorter waves that are generated by wind wouldn't really affect.
So you did an initial look at the risk assessment, compared it to other instances of landslides that you'd seen in your experience. And this eventually made it to the desk of Dr. Shunli Dai at Ohio State University Bird, Polar, and Climate Research Center. Dr. Shunli, are you still with us?
Yes.
Wonderful. So can you talk a little bit about how you got involved in this project, and especially your satellite imagery analysis? It is incredible the things that we can determine now through technology. So if you could talk about that, that would be wonderful.
So we were working on mapping landslides using satellite imagery. It was funded by a NASA program. So we were working on this program together, and Dr. Anna, she knows Dr. Hickman, so she connected us together, and then Dr. Hickman gave me like 30 sites that he thinks in Alaska that has a potential landslide risk. So I was really happy to get this collection of landslide sites so I can look at it with the satellite data. So in the beginning, we look at this particular site because it's a popular tourist site. So we're using our data set to look at it. Our initial results are actually not so good because the data we got is, we only got one pair of data and one of the imagery is cloudy. So I show the results at our weekly meeting and everyone's like, oh, this is too noisy. That can be true. Like, well, I have a little confidence in the results because there are good controls in stable areas, and this signal is show up. It's really coherent over a large scale. But then it's true, I agree, like it's very noisy because of the clouds and things. So I was like, oh yeah, maybe it's not so convincing. We need more data. So after the meeting, I was like, maybe I can check more data sets from other satellite missions. So first thing, I like what Dr. Hickman did was looking at the Google's imagery, and I flip through, see they have this like a video time lapse, so you can see the changes. It's interesting. Like I spent some time to take the animation, try to emphasize the changes, and to show it to our colleagues. It takes me a while, and then after a little while, I realized it's not so obvious. Well, I was like, maybe it's not so good. Then before I move on to other sites, I was like, maybe I sent Dr. Hickman an email. Instead of showing him what I tried to show him, I just say, hey, I see these changes in Google's. Why don't you take a look? And then he take a look and he agrees. He see the changes really large scale. And then that's everything started to get really interesting, and I started to work on, really spend a lot of time on it using different satellite imageries. So mapping the time series. So we measure like up to 400 feet of horizontal displacement over 7 years between 2010 and 2017. So that's very significant. So we like analyze about hundreds of pairs of satellite imageries, do some estimates, also the size over 1 mile's width. So that's really significant, and we pretty convinced that it's a real danger.
Yeah, so your initial reaction from folks in that meeting that you were talking about saying, we think maybe this data's too noisy, you should probably do a little more research. So was it just that the result was just a little tough to wrap your brain around then? Like, is it really, really this big, or do we need to study more? I mean, it sounds like your follow-up conclusions were right in line with your initial look at that slope.
Yeah. The main concern is, one is too noisy, two is the size is just too big. It's the largest, like three times in the area, larger than the 10th landslide. So it's too big. It's hardly believable.
And you're able to determine all of that just through satellite imagery. This is not sending a crew out to hike up the slope and take measurements. This is just looking at, like you say, Google Earth and other satellite imagery, historic yes. compared to now. That is pretty incredible that you're able to get that kind of an assessment of something without, you know, putting people in danger, having them climb all over this thing either.
Thanks to all the satellite missions that we have. Like we have Landsat imagery since, the good ones I analyzed this back in 2000. So we got 20 years of imagery.
Yeah, that is pretty incredible. Okay, mm-hmm. So Haig, as you're working back and forth with Dr. Shunli then, did it take a little convincing for you as well to come to terms with the scope of how big this slide could actually be?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I was definitely one of the skeptics when she presented her first results. I think of these landslides as having a lot of complexity where different little pieces are moving in different ways. And she showed this initial result where everything that she could see through the hole in the clouds that she had was moving the same. And it's easy for me to imagine how that could arise from some sort of problem in the data. And so that was where my brain went first. And just as Shunli said, you know, she sent me an email saying, hey, I think I can see it in this Google time lapse. And I knew that those images in that time lapse come from Landsat, which is one of the satellites that's been taking pictures for a long time. And so I pulled a bunch of images from Landsat, and it turned out two of them from, I think, 2013 and 2015, I could flip back and forth between them. They're really beautiful images. You can see the glacier. You can see the glacier retreating. You can see the snow is different in each one. So there are a bunch of changes. The one change you see is this whole chunk of the mountain just translates out. And this is a very low-resolution image. It does, I think, they're 30-meter pixels, so like 100 feet for each pixel in the picture. Normally, it's not something I would expect to be able to see a landslide in. But in this case, just as Shunli had discovered, the motion is big enough that it really shows up. And when I took that and sort of reached out to other people that I know of who have expertise in the different pieces of this question, people who study glacial retreat and landslides and tsunamis and so on. And what I did is I sent them just two little pieces of this image and said, hey, flip back and forth between these and you'll see what I'm talking about. And I think just like me, that was really convincing for a lot of people and including Gabe, who's on this call here. At some level, I think one of the things that's striking about this story is that we should not have been surprised by this. Like, we should have noticed this slope, you know, a decade ago or longer. I mean, you can actually see evidence of instability even back into the photos from the 50s. But nobody had looked. None of us who study this sort of event, this sort of hazard, had ever gone and looked at this place, and so we'd never seen it. everything was there to see it. There's everything you could ask for as far as it being easy to spot was there. But it was sort of this, you know, somewhat stumbling process that led us coincidentally to find it, rather than what we might like to say as scientists is that, oh, we systematically studied all of Alaska and this spot showed up as being really important. But that's not the case. We haven't systematically studied all of Alaska. And this was just a coincidence that we came across this.
Well, hiding in plain sight, I think there is not a better example of that phrase.
Yep.
So once it was established that, okay, yes, this is looking like it's a real threat, then it moved into the, well, how big of a threat? What time frame are we looking at? Tsunami modeling, all of that kind of thing. And I think that's where Dr. Wolkin comes into the conversation with the Alaska Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys and a research professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And you were saying that you have a program that researches hazards in Alaska posed by snow ice melt and permafrost melt. So this sounds like definitely in your wheelhouse. So when did you get involved and what was your role in moving this forward?
Yeah, well, I was actually one of the recipients of Higgs' email where he sent two Landsat satellite images and with the question, you know, basically, are you seeing what I'm seeing? And is this, you know, does this look like a convincing large landslide? And you know, we're trained to be skeptics. And so initially I looked at that and I thought, yeah, it could be some shift. I compared it to some stable areas. I immediately went to the Landsat record and evaluated many of the different images for that area independently and concluded exactly the same thing, that this was indeed something that that really needed attention very quickly. And the program that I manage is the Climate and Cryosphere Hazards Program. And we do look at these things across the state. I mean, just changes in snow, ice, and permafrost create a number of hazards in Alaska, particularly with the changing climate. And so there is an increased risk in landslides throughout the state, and in particular in Southeast Alaska. And there are plenty of examples of this in Southeast Alaska. The big difference here is that most of the time when we have a large landslide or a large slope collapse, it's after the fact. And so in this case, we're not going out to a slide that happened already. We're not being notified by the seismologists around the world that they detected something that was huge and registered as a shake on the seismic network. In this case, we have a group of people who identified a slope that was changing, and that motion then was detected in several different ways, and we were able to come to a consensus that, yeah, this is indeed a serious issue, and we better start looking at it. We better come to a consensus on the imminent threat that it poses, and that's kind of what led us to where we are today.
As you say, in the past in Alaska, I mean, Lituya Bay and Tan Fjord, as you've discussed, are the two largest landslide-caused tsunamis that we have, at least in recorded state history. And I would imagine the process is a lot different, as you say, to study a landslide and the effects and the tsunami that have happened. I mean, you can measure the height depending on wave height on opposite walls of a canyon or the height of trees that got knocked over versus trying to figure out how it might happen in the future. How do you study that? How do you look at a slope and try and determine, okay, there's maybe this many cubic meters of rock and dirt. What might happen if that comes down?
Yeah, well, there are a few different approaches. And with the Berry Arm landslide, we're really getting off the ground right now with starting this. And the first thing we're going to do is collect some baseline data. And some of that is baseline topographic data. And so we are planning a LIDAR survey of this area. And this is something that we do, that we conduct. And we're going to get very high resolution data of the landslide itself, of the topographic features of the landslide itself so that we can start to map the different features of this moving part of the slope. We're going to continue to track it with repeat surveys and using satellite imagery as well. And then what we also hope to do in very short order, and this is all funding dependent right now, we're trying to get everybody organized with this multi-agency, multi-institute collaboration to install some real-time monitoring networks so that we can keep track of the motion of the landslide in the short term. There are a number of different approaches that we can use for this, but using our colleagues in the seismology world and installing sensors that have a continuous feed of a GPS position on the slope and compared to that off the slope so that we can find out how it's moving. And ultimately, with that information, hopefully we can have the start of a warning system for that. And then we can develop this much further to really come to grips with the threat and to assess it in the way that it needs to be assessed.
I'd like to shift this a little bit to public safety. So I don't know, Haig or Gabe, which one of you wants to take this, but what should folks be aware of? What should they be looking out for? How should they be planning to stay safe if they're going to be out in the sound? I know no one can give us a date for when this slide might happen, but time frame is anywhere from within a year to within two decades. So this is something people should be getting used to being aware of.
I could speak to that a little bit first, and I'm sure Gabe can add to it. This sort of landslide and then, well, so the landslide itself, first of all, if you were sitting on the slope and the landslide happened, that would be very bad. But generally, people aren't, right? This is a very unstable slope. Most likely, you know, the landslide itself is not what gets you in trouble. It's the fact that this landslide goes into water and then generates a wave, a tsunami, that then can propagate over a large area. So tsunami is a term that the most famous tsunamis that have happened in recent times are generated by earthquakes, and there are some big differences between a tsunami generated by a landslide and a tsunami generated by an earthquake. An earthquake-generated tsunami is generated over a pretty large area, and it has a very long period. It can have an impact that even crosses oceans, like we had in 2011 with the tsunami in Japan. It was especially destructive there, but it also caused damage in California, New Zealand, other places. Landslide tsunamis are much more localized in their source, and if you think of it as the period or the wavelength of the wave is much shorter. So the amount of time it takes the water to rise and fall and the amount of space from the beginning of the wave to the tail of it is less. And that means they can be more destructive locally because they break really violently, but they also tend to dissipate more quickly as they travel. So with the exception of the very largest landslides in geologic time, most landslides are impact mostly the local area. And what that means varies a bit. And I really, coming into this project, I had the mindset of having looked at Tonfjord and where the impacts really tapered off within 20 or so miles of the source. And so I was really focused very much on Barry Arm and Harriman Fjord. After a little while, we engaged with a scientist at the University of Southern California, Pat Lynette, who has a model for tsunamis, and he can quite quickly model how a tsunami would spread. He has to know a little bit about what the source of that tsunami is. So there's a lot we don't know about this landslide. And so he had to work with essentially a guess at what the landslide would be like. Using his model, he showed that that the hazard posed by the tsunami, if it were generated by a complete failure of this Barry Arm landslide, might be more widespread than what I initially anticipated. And in particular, it might have pretty severe impacts in Whittier. There's a tremendous amount we don't know about, the accuracy of this model and that sort of thing. From having pretty extensive conversations with Pat about his model, my sense is that this is a useful first look at what the hazard is. And the reason that, even though he had to kind of guess the landslide, I think that this is a useful starting point, is that the landslide, if it fails completely, again, of course, if a small portion fails, then it will be less dangerous and the story would come out differently. But if the whole mass fails, even if we're off by, you know, maybe it's only three quarters as big as we think it is, or maybe it's 1.5 times as big, it's big enough that it will fill all of the upper part of Berry Arm. So that means it's likely to be constrained not by the size of the landslide. So it's the limit on how big it is not the size of the landslide, it is the amount of water underneath it. And it's also probably not that dependent on the speed, because as long as the landslide doesn't move incredibly slowly, it'll push this water out of the arm. And what it'll do is generate a tsunami that essentially starts at the place where Berry Arm and Harriman Fjord meet. And it has a volume, initial volume, that's similar to the volume of water in that upper arm. So it's a simplistic assumption. That's a lot of details, I realize. But the point is, we're trying to figure out what can we say right now without doing more work. If you go from that idea, then you see a wave arriving in Whittier about 18 minutes after the landslide, and then it would peak a few minutes after that. And the raw model results say 12 meters, which is about 40 feet, and there's certainly a lot of uncertainty in that. It could be a bit less, so we've been just saying 30 feet or more is kind of where we're as our starting point. And it would be a very destructive tsunami. You know, the water rising 30 or more feet in 3 minutes is very, very violent. It would break and cause strong currents. And then the water would retreat after that. So one, and I'll interject on myself here, that one point of confusion about tsunamis is the idea of a leading withdrawal, so when the water retreats before the tsunami arrives. This is more common than not with tectonic tsunamis, with earthquake-generated tsunamis. In most cases, not all cases, but most cases, there is a withdrawal of the water first. But with a landslide tsunami, we typically don't expect that. We would not expect there to be a withdrawal of the water first. So the first wave arriving in Whittier would be the one that floods inland, not a withdrawal. So it doesn't provide that bit of natural warning right in advance. But I don't know if there's something maybe Gabe would like to add or clarify in that overview.
That's a great thing to point out. Those of us who have especially grown up in Alaska, all of our earthquake training since we were kids up till now, and the tsunami warning system is always, you know, look for the retreating water, and that's how you know a tsunami is coming. But different thing when it's a landslide-caused tsunami than an earthquake-caused tsunami. So, Gabe, do you have anything that you want to add as far as what folks should be looking out for or how this might propagate throughout the Sound?
Well, I think Higg did an excellent job with summarizing that. And I think the thing that I would just add is just to put it in people's minds that, you know, we don't know at this point when or even if this unstable slope will release. And that's why we want to really follow up with some sound science to understand this more. It was significant enough for our group of collaborators to, you know, issue a warning and to identify this as an imminent threat. And just to, you know, kind of put it in layman's terms, this is massive, right? And so if it did go, that's why it's so important to understand what it could do, because we have an opportunity now to identify this as a potential hazard. Whereas, as I mentioned before, most of the time, we simply don't have this option because we have such a poor understanding of the number and location of possible landslides and unstable slopes throughout South Central and Southeast Alaska. And we need to do better on that. But in this case, we do know. And, you know, the initial volume estimates on here, as Higg said, they're educated guesses based on what we know about other slopes. But the fact remains that even if we're off by a little bit with these estimates, it's still massive. And this one, as it's currently estimated with these initial estimations or guesses, it would be about the size of around 500 Empire State Buildings, falling into the fjord at once if it did release as a solid mass on the unstable slope. And so just to put that in your listeners' minds, it's incredibly large. It's a huge mass that could fall into the fjord. And then the result is the water that's displaced from that then gets transmitted throughout the sound. And there are some places that are more dangerous than others. And he can probably talk a little bit more to this, but generally the shallow areas are going to be dangerous. And the deeper areas, if you're out on the water, are going to be less dangerous. And so people need to have that in mind and to also be mindful of some of the precursors. We have an opportunity to look around, and Alaskans are great at understanding the environment that they're in. And most of the time they've been in these places and really noticed the changes. And I've been getting lots and lots of emails and phone calls of people who have noticed this slope. What they also should notice then is any precursor activity, any falling rock or instabilities that would point to some activity on the slope, and to just be aware of that and communicate that to us.
Yeah, I would definitely second the seeing rocks or small masses falling. I mean, that is, it's a good sign to maybe get out of the area if you were in Barrie Fjord and Barrie Arm and you saw material coming down the slope. That can mean that there is increased deformation of the slope, which often precedes a failure. So this is our hope with this, with being able to monitor the slope, is that we would be able to detect some change in the slope that might happen hours or days or even a little bit longer prior to failure. And so we would be looking at maybe GPS measurements of this slope shifting. Maybe we would be able to see some change. But if you're there, what you might well see is you might see rocks falling down, because as that slope speeds up prior to failure, and like Gabe said, it may never fail, but if it were to fail, it's likely it would accelerate a little bit before that. And so you would see rocks falling and that sort of thing. So that would both be a good time to leave, and any of us, you know, Gabe or me or anyone who's involved with this, I would be happy to hear from you if you saw something like that. Any sort of, get out of there first, but, you know, then let us know. This is potentially pretty useful information. And I have received one set of videos from someone who witnessed rock falls on that slope a couple of years ago.
And of course, if you're not, which hopefully you're not going to be in Barrie Arm when this starts, but if you're a little farther out, I think at one point you mentioned there might be some other signals in the water. Are we looking for some cloudiness going on in the water?
Yeah, tsunamis in general, you know, sometimes there is some change in water level that precedes anything dangerous. And when that change in water level happens, well, there have to be currents to allow that water level to change, right? So if you're in a bay and the water level goes up an inch, then quite a lot of water has to flow in the mouth of that bay. So if it goes up an inch in a minute, then that's a very strong current. You might notice the current, or you might notice sediment stirred up. For a tsunami like Barrie Arm, like if Barrie Arm failed and a complete failure of this very large landslide generated tsunami, you may not get much warning of that sort, but maybe a little bit. It might give you 30 seconds or something of warning before there were other obvious signs. If you're in a place where you can see the coast, the wave will probably be quite obvious where it's hitting the coast, even some distance away from you. So that would potentially provide a little bit of warning too. But again, very little. They travel so fast that it would be a very short warning. One of the things that we just discussed this in a meeting yesterday, that it's kind of an open question, but historically landslides like this are quite loud. And so it's possible that you would actually hear something that would indicate there had been a landslide, even if you were some distance away. I don't know how far that sound might travel. But again, if I were out there, if I were in Port Wells and I heard, you know, some big rumbling or roaring sound, I would say, well, I don't know what that is, but maybe it was this landslide. And so this is a good time to flee to high ground, or if I was out in a boat, to move into deeper water. I wanted to specifically address, and Gabe already said a little bit about this, but the you know, what to do in a boat. It's really clear if your boat is on the beach or tied up at the dock that you want to go up onto shore. You know, abandon the boat, get out of there, and go up to high ground, because getting above the tsunami is the safest place to be. If you were already out in fairly deep water, you want to stay there or go to deeper water. So those two situations are unequivocal. Of course, there are a lot of places where you might be in a boat but in shallow water, and you're faced with this decision. Do you try to get to shore and go up to higher ground, or do you go out into deeper water? And I spent some time, actually just last night, thinking about this interview, reading through official advice for mariners. And their advice is to travel to quite deep water. And if you can't get to really deep water, you need to be headed towards land. So they say 50 fathoms, so 300 feet, or 100 fathoms, 600 feet, depending on where you are. This advice doesn't necessarily apply in a simple way to this case. That advice is very much built around tectonic tsunamis, where often you would have a little bit more warning, first of all. You have more chance to go to land. And also it would be the hazard is largely focused on these strong currents generated by the tectonic tsunamis. Now, strong currents are still a big concern, and that's something that as a mariner, if you were out on the water, you would want to be very alert to that. You could be in pretty deep water, but if it's a narrow channel, expect to have really violent currents moving through there. And so that's a big concern. However, given the short time period and given that Prince William Sound is actually fairly protected water, so you don't have those currents interacting with open ocean swells. You also don't have the leading withdrawal that gives you time but also generates really strong currents. I think that the balance leans more towards taking your boat into deeper water than it would for a tectonic tsunami. So in other words, if you knew that that you were facing a landslide generated tsunami, then I would say, and you were in your boat and it wasn't moored to shore already, you weren't already on shore, I would say that fleeing to deeper water, even if you can't get to 50 fathoms, even if you can only get to 10 fathoms depth, that may well be your safest move. But it's a very hard call. It's not a call, you know, I want anyone to have to make. You know, it's very dependent on the specific situation you're in and on what would be involved with, you know, how fast does your boat go, what would be involved with beaching, and how quickly can you reach high ground from the beach. All of those questions would be part of that decision. Something I would interject into that, I've done interviews of people who survived tsunamis in Thailand, the 2004 tsunami there, and one of the things that really struck me there is how people who didn't know what was happening and had to just come up with what they should do on the fly, they really struggled to come up with any sort of rational response. I spoke to one person who, I mean, they did just what you wanted. They fled to the highest point of ground, and I asked them, well, did you know about tsunamis? Did you think, okay, this is a good place to go? And she said, no, I have no idea why I went up that hill. I don't even remember what happened. I think that it's very helpful for people to think through these scenarios beforehand. So if you are out, in Prince William Sound somewhere and aware that this possibility exists, just spend a minute or two imagining what would you do in your particular situation if you saw signs of a tsunami on the way. And having that plan might really help you act in the very narrow window of time that you have to put yourself in a safer position.
So given the danger, given the lack of forewarning that someone is likely to have, given the possibility of, at a minimum, property destruction, but possibly loss of life, and certainly destruction in Whittier. I mean, that is obviously a harbor town. Is there any discussion of possibly triggering a slide? Not that you can control a slide, but similar idea to avalanche mitigation on the Seward Highway. We know this is likely going to come down. Why don't we close the highway, get everybody out of the way, and make it happen?
This question comes up a lot, and it's certainly an interesting idea, right? And we know about avalanche safety, as you're saying, like triggering avalanches before they might happen. I think that, you know, if you were the ruler of everything and you were doing some careful cost-benefit analysis, I could conceivably see that there might be a scenario where you might try that. But if you actually look at it in terms of how do we practically do this, there's some really big questions that I think make it questionable that it'd be possible to do that well. And one of them is just the simple logistical question of how do you trigger this safely? And that's, you know, maybe would involve like putting drill rigs on the slide mass and putting explosives or injecting high pressure water in there to try to trigger it to move. That's going to be really difficult to do safely. But let's say you figure that trick out. Now, what if you try it and it doesn't work? Landslides are much more varied and unpredictable in their character than snowpack. And so it's perfectly possible you would go up there, you think you've got it all figured out, you set off your explosives or whatever, and then the slide doesn't happen. Well, do you try again? What happens if you walk away at that point and then nothing happens for 3 months and then it fails? Would it have failed in 3 months if you hadn't detonated a bunch of explosives in the middle of it? Maybe you made it more unstable and increased the risk. And let's say that instead of that, everything goes perfectly, you trigger a huge landslide. Now, do you know there's not going to be another one? We can look at cases like Lituya Bay, and it's actually typical for slopes to produce multiple landslides. Lituya Bay probably experienced five or more huge landslides that generated destructive tsunamis. So if you go out there and you successfully trigger one, you haven't necessarily, you know, avoided the problem. Well, yeah, anyway, I don't even think this is practical, but like an interesting just thought experiment is if you could somehow fill in the fjord, that would be actually in some ways, I think, more realistic as far as a way of protecting against things, because it would be safe. However, you're talking about moving, you know, an entire mountain worth of material into the fjord, which would be logistically incredible feat.
Right. We're getting into science fiction at this point rather than science, I think. Okay, well, we are getting up toward the top of the hour, and one last thing I wanted to talk about today, and Gabe and Hig, this is probably your wheelhouse as well, and you did mention Gruent Glacier across Ketchumak Bay over in Belisa and Hig's neck of the woods. Are there other areas of the state in particular that folks should be aware of? I mean, we've certainly got retreating glaciers, retreating tidewater glaciers all over the state. And Gabe, you mentioned particularly in Southeast Alaska. As you also mentioned, this is not something where we've studied every single glacier in the state to determine the possible likelihood of a slide and a tsunami. But as people are out recreating, out fishing, living in coastal communities, we are all drawn to glaciers. So what awareness should folks have of a possibility like this elsewhere?
Yeah, I can start off with this, and I'll just give a little bit of a backdrop. The fjords of Alaska are quite a draw to everyone, and not just tourism, but they're amazingly productive areas too. And so people like to fish in these areas, and it's a place where people like to go to just get away and be with nature. I mean, it's breathtakingly beautiful in most of these places. But Barry Glacier, like nearly all the glaciers around the world, are melting and retreating in response to a warming climate. And in the glaciers in Alaska are some of the fastest melting glaciers on the planet. And so as these continue to retreat, then these landslide hazards and other hazards emerge as threats to these rapid changes and are in response to these rapid changes. And it's important to know that when you're in these areas, this is a place of rapid environmental change. And one just needs to be vigilant when out in these areas and to just be aware of the hazards that are out there. We currently don't have a large scale or statewide landslide hazard assessment. We need one. And hopefully from seeing a situation like this develop and the possible consequences, maybe we'll get some focus on this, and hopefully we can start to provide a large-scale assessment of where some of these dangers exist. And, you know, we have the tools to do that. And, you know, some of the work that Chun-Li is doing right now is a great first start in getting a broad-scale assessment of where some of these possible unstable slopes might be. And we know that certainly glaciers in Southeast Alaska, in particular around the Glacier National Park region, at Glacier Bay area, this is a hot spot of slope movement in the world right now. There are some tremendously large rock avalanches and landslides that have occurred in this area, and some of which are terminating in the fjords. So it's just, we know it's happening. It's happening in lots of different places, and people just need to simply be very vigilant when they're out in these areas.
I would use kind of an analogy here. I mean, we all are familiar with volcanoes as a hazard. You know, you can look out and look at a mountain, and it's kind of conical and it's taller than the ones around it, and you say, oh, that's a volcano. And if you get to know a volcano, you might know that some are actually not that dangerous. You know, people can live right there. There might be some risk still. Maybe it's not quite as inactive as we think. But another one might be extremely active, and no one would want to spend any time really near it. Of course, they're all beautiful places. I love going to volcanoes, and kind of the more active, the better in terms of how dramatic the landscape is. What we're starting to see with climate change is that these deglaciating landscapes are sort of similar to volcanoes. They're locations where natural processes are concentrating a lot of energy. In this case, instead of it being geothermal energy, it's potential energy in terms of these big slopes that would like to become flatter. They would like to settle down into the valleys below. And some of them are particularly worrisome on a particularly big scale. But unlike volcanoes that we've known about that hazard all throughout history and prehistory, we're very familiar with that. But with this rapid deglaciation is a relatively new thing, and for us to be dealing with. And so we're still kind of grappling with how, as a society, to adapt to the fact that there is this hazard that exists in these places. And so I think that's one of the big challenges I see in all of this. And, you know, I agree with Gabe that we need the sort of systematic, broad view of this, as well as the very focused work like we're initiating here at Barry Glacier in Barry Arm to understand specific hazards. We need this kind of broader look. And so I think, you know, all your listeners can think about, you know, where are the places where you know that the glacier is retreating really fast, you know that there are steep slopes and there's deep water beneath them. Those are your basic risk factors: high, steep slopes, retreating glacier, and deep water. And then you can add to that, if you went and actually walked around on those slopes, you might find evidence of cracking or whatever. Maybe there wouldn't be any such evidence, but the slope, it turns out to be unstable after all. But that anyone, you know, just looking at a map can kind of figure out where the question exists. And at this point, we can't really say that there are any such slopes that we've gone and studied well enough to say, hey, we're confident that this is not a concern. Now, there really is only a very limited number of these slopes that have been studied seriously.
And we are going to have to leave it there. Thank you all so much. This has been fascinating and terrifying at the same time. But the more information we have, the more safe we are going to stay. So thank you so much to Valisa and Higg and Dr. Chun-Li Dai at Ohio State University and Dr. Gabriel Wolken with the Alaska Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys and UAF. This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Thanks for tuning in.